I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Kansas City may be pretty far from the coast, but one local institution is hoping to bring the ocean just a little bit closer to home. Today we'll talk to the director of the Kansas City Zoo about a proposed 700,000-gallon aquarium and why he wants public money to build it. Then the Human Rights Watch in Washington, D.C. hasn't had many vacation days since Donald J. Trump took office. We'll learn what effect the president's words and actions have had on ensuring the rights of others and what people here can do to help humanitarian efforts around the world. We'll finish today with Brian McTavish and his weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. There's a lot to see and do at the zoo these days, from old standbys like the elephants and chimpanzees and new favorites like Stingray Bay, where you can touch and feed stingrays. But the Kansas City Zoo CEO and Executive Director Randy Wistoff wants to add yet another attraction, a 700,000-gallon aquarium. Plans to secure money for the project from the city of Kansas City are being taken up today by the council. Here to discuss the proposal is Randy Wistoff himself. Randy, welcome back. Always good to have you here.
Good to see you, Steve.
Doesn't Kansas City already have an aquarium, Randy?
We do. It's a smaller version of what we want to bring to Kansas City.
In Crown Center, right?
Crown Center, Sea Life. Mm-hmm. That is more tied with Legoland, geared for young children, and it's about a third of the size of what we intend to do.
You know, the recent controversy here was over a $7 million ask of the city for the aquarium. But before we talk about that, you guys have already raised more than $60 million. Where's that money coming from?
We've got our tax district sales tax that we've carved out a portion of that every year to put towards major capital projects. We've tried to maximize the use of that, different projects, different things. But when we pulled that originally and went to the voters, we told them we would be adding major attractions with that money. So we've been holding some of that aside since we started the discussions about a major aquarium. So we've got $40 million earmarked for a $75 million aquarium out of that. And we've been out talking to individuals, groups, foundations about the private side. And I've got about $22 million earmarked right now, pledged, all kind of contingent that the city participates also.
I was going to say, why not just ask those donors for a little more money to cover the remaining costs? Why come back to the city again?
Because it is a city asset. Everything we've done, Friends of the Zoo operates the zoo for the city. Anything we do there since I've been here, we've added $86 million worth of improvements, both front of the house, back of the house. We've had to go back and repair old barns and roofs and pathways. So it's an investment in the city. It belongs to the city. And the donors have really kind of strongly had felt that since it's a city asset, asking them for 10% is really a fair trade-off, and they want them to participate as well.
Is there a concern that these donors might pull their money if the city doesn't put some skin in the game?
I think our major donors as most major donors, they want to be the last money in. So I've got pledge letters, but it's contingent on us raising all the funds before that money's released. So that gap is what we still have to fill. And we've had meetings with the donors and city leaders, and it's always been kind of understood that there was an expectation that the city participate in this project.
So the answer to the question is perhaps yes.
Perhaps yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, once again, one concern out there is that it's the city of Kansas City footing the bill here for an amenity that has metro-wide appeal, and some folks struggle with that.
I think they do, but it is in the heart of the city. It's a city attraction. It's what makes Kansas City, Kansas City. The major sort of amenities, the tourist attractions, are all located in the city of Kansas City. Union Station, World War I Museum, the Nelson, the Kemper Museum are in the heart of the city. And the The zoo and Starlight have always been kind of the jewels of Swope Park to bring residents in there, and the jobs we create, the economic impact that we hope we can drive, the future growth in attendance, and potential development projects along 71, 63rd Street, Meyer Boulevard, I think would lead to more us bringing more funds in. In the big picture, I think we're responsible for we could be up to $43 million economic impact every year if our attendance hits what our projections are on the aquarium. So I think the trade back or the trade out is for a small investment long term. This is a good deal for the city of Kansas City. Plus, it adds 100 jobs.
And in fairness, there is this zoo district sales tax that extends beyond the borders of Kansas City, Missouri. Fill us in for listeners maybe who have forgotten what that's all about.
We went to the voters, we went to Missouri legislature a number of years ago and received authorizing legislation to create a tax. We patterned it after the property tax that was formulated years ago over in St. Louis for the Forest Park District, and the zoo receives property tax over there. Ours was a sales tax, went to the voters. We had authorization to go to four counties. Two counties agreed to put it on a ballot, Jackson and Clay. Mm-hmm. And annually that support was really strong, and the voters kind of overwhelmingly supported that because of the things we told them we would, their benefits would be. So there are special benefits within for the county residents, free days, discount days, education programs that are dedicated and free to the school districts. So the give back is much stronger for the residents of Jackson and Clay County.
Well, why not just raise ticket prices, admission prices?
Well, that has been suggested, but it's a math deal that raising a ticket price. Really, I don't know of any institution that just raises ticket prices to try to raise capital funds. Most of what you get in your ticket price goes for the day-to-day operation of any facility. It was suggested we raise the ticket price a dollar. Well, we have 1 million visitors a year. Raising it a dollar would say, hey, we can raise $1 million. It just doesn't work that way. We have our free tickets to our Jackson and Clay County residents. That right there is about 75,000 visitors a year, so they don't pay admission. Mm-hmm. We have school groups that come in on free programs in Jackson and Clay County. I think that's in the neighborhood of 100,000 kids. We do give free zoo tickets. Because we are, what we want to be is for everybody. Everybody should be able to come to the zoo. We give a lot of free tickets to United Way agencies in the metro area, thousands of tickets a year. We have other school groups that come to the zoo at a discounted rate, and every time we try to raise the ticket price on that, we get pushback from the school district saying, hey, we just can't afford another hit because of, and these are Johnson County and Platte County school kids who should be able to come to the zoo. They don't get in free, but for a discounted rate. So it isn't as easy as just throwing mm-hmm. another buck on and saying, well, that would raise the money. Out of a dollar, every time we raise admission price a dollar, we net about 30 cents.
Huh.
When that falls to the bottom line because of all the discounts and the different things we do.
Randy Wistoff, the head of the Kansas City Zoo, is my guest. We're talking about the proposal for a new aquarium out at the zoo, $75 million. So where are we today then? The original proposal was to seek $7 million out of general obligation bonds that the voters approved not that long ago. The STARS editorial board, which I'm a member of, came out against that, saying that's not an appropriate use of that money. The city council is taking this situation up today. What's the latest thinking about where the $7 million might come from?
Well, I think the latest resolution proposed by Councilman McManus and co-sponsored by Councilwoman Kennedy calls for the support at the $7 million level. But it gives the city manager and the council 60 days to try to figure out where that funding stream would come from. So they creatively can find the money. It wouldn't come from maybe one source, but would be a number of sources. And we're able, with cash flow, we'd be able to spread that out over about a 5-year period.
Okay. Well, give our radio audience some sense, Randy, for how much aquarium $75 million buys, because how big is this thing going to be?
About an acre and a half footprint, wow. 65 to 70,000 square feet is what we're shooting for. Somewhere between 650,000 and 750,000 gallons of water. If anybody's been up to my old haunt in Omaha and been to the aquarium there, that's about ballpark the size of that aquarium. We built that in the mid-90s in Omaha. That was the biggest change agent that we ever had when we added all those big attractions in Omaha. That was the one major exhibit that raised our attendance the most, held our attendance at a high level, and still is one of the most popular exhibits
because
up there.
Because this is a 365-day-a-year attraction, right?
That's what it adds to the Kansas City Zoo that has been really missing in over the 100-year history of the zoo. Almost all the energy was put into exhibits that are primarily outdoor. And I hate to say it, but we've as zoo visitors, we're not quite as hardy as we used to be. And when it's too hot or too cold or too rainy or too anything, people do want to go somewhere and be in climate-controlled environments.
And this is going to be that place.
This will be that place. It'll be 365. It'll be a destination where actually you come to the zoo for a visit. And it will be included in your zoo admission. If you come in and pay a zoo admission, you have family membership or even a free day, we're not going to charge you anything extra to get into this exhibit.
How many animals are we talking about here, Randy? I mean, what kinds of animals would viewers get to see? I mean, saltwater, freshwater, what are we looking at here?
Primarily, focus will be saltwater. Warm ocean primarily would be Atlantic, Gulf, and cold ocean, Pacific. So we could show a variety and kind of a diversity of animals that live under the surface. We would, of course, feature big sharks, 10, 12-foot sharks would be kind of that signature animal. We've also been working with Monterey Aquarium on bringing in sea otters, part of their rescue program. They're one of the most renowned and well-respected aquariums in the world.
Right.
We would be featuring just a lot of, I can't sort of pinpoint how many animals, because when you get into jellyfish and schooling fish, you're sort of inflating numbers by the thousands. And it could be a relatively small tank that would hold those species. But we would have a great diversity and try to earmark things that aren't already exhibited in town at Sea Life, so that there's a good reason to go to both aquariums and enjoy the exhibits and tell conservation stories. We're real concerned about the plight of the ocean these days, and being here landlocked as far away from an ocean as you can get, we feel it's an important story to tell to kids, adults, and to learn about oceans.
I'm wondering about jobs. Again, remind us how many additional staff you're going to need if this aquarium happens.
For the aquarium building itself, it probably will be 20 to 25 individuals that it would take to run it on a daily basis. But in our growth spurt that we've gone through, we're projecting that we're going to go from 1 million to 1.4 million with the addition of the aquarium. And that's based on what happened at the Omaha Zoo and other zoos that built aquariums and major exhibits like this. Over the past few years, we've risen our attendance from 600,000 to 1 million. In that time frame, we have added 100 full-time equivalents. Most of those are full-time, a number of part-time that add up to that many hours. So we're just projecting ahead because we'll need more ticket takers, we'll need more groundskeepers, more custodial, more people in the development department, the PR department, and HR department. So it's just an overall growth in all the different departments. We have 10 different departments at the zoo, so there would be growth in all of them. And cumulative, we'd add 100 jobs.
You know, talk to me about the quality of these jobs. You know, I know that a lot of your employees have to work second jobs to make ends meet. Yeah. I get that we're talking about a nonprofit organization here, but what quality of job are we talking about with this expansion here?
At the low end are going to be, and we increase salaries every year, not greatly, but we have tried over the last few years to do that. We're talking jobs from the $25,000 a year range to 50, 60, 70. It depends on the technology, the training, the education that's needed for some of the aquarists. What we'd have to add another veterinarian, mm-hmm. more veterinary technicians, curators, and staff in our professional development departments. So it would be really all over the place,
right.
But anywhere from low to mid to high range.
Randy Wistoff is my guest, the head of the Kansas City Zoo. We're talking about that proposed new aquarium. You know, the African Congo loop at the zoo, the part across the big swinging bridge, is suffering from pretty serious erosion out there. Does that need to be a higher priority than a new aquarium right now, or can you handle both?
That section of the zoo was identified years ago when I first got here as a high priority with the Corps of Engineers. And since that time, it's pretty much been deemed that whole bank side is not going to be repaired. It's too big a project. And so
are you having to move animals as a result?
Over time, and it's going to take a long time for that river to cut through there. But over time, that will be cut through. It's a geological phenomenon. It'll become an oxbow lake. So our long-range plans really call at some point in time to move the gorillas over to the other side. And anything on the other side, that suspension bridge just won't be there anymore. We'll abandon that property. It's just too large. The return on investment over there is too great. It's cheaper and easier to move the animals.
You know, you came to Kansas City after some success revitalizing the Henry Dorley Zoo in Omaha. What's your approach to keeping, you know, a zoo current and relevant and even attractive to the public?
It starts with cleanliness.
That's the key.
That's one of the keys. Making animals visible the minute people walk into the zoo. That wasn't happening here. So we recreated a lower parking lot, a drop-off zone. We made the zoo much easier to get into, user-friendly, cleanliness, clean bathrooms,
right.
Animals you can see. We tried to design all of our exhibits so that you could see the animals for kids that are even sitting in strollers. It's pretty simple. The dynamics of what need to happen is just the execution that's been important. And then always we have to add new exhibits, big-time things to get people to come back out and see us again.
Hey, how do you balance improving existing facilities versus adding new attractions?
That is a balancing game. We have to look at monies that we make available in our tax district. We've set aside money for deferred maintenance. Every year we're tackling things. A lot of it you don't see, but we've been replacing pathways out in Africa. We've got almost all those pathways replaced now. We have put on a number of new roofs. We've rehabilitated a number of the buildings. We've tried to take an exhibit every year and repurpose it, make it a little bit better habitat for the animals.
Did you ask members of the public, friends of the zoo, or other groups about this plan before you rolled it out? How did you manage all
that? Yes, we polled pretty heavily on the aquarium proposal itself in just Kansas City proper. We polled in all seven or all six city council districts. Overall, the approval rate for an aquarium was 70%. And then it got into specifics of our creating jobs was a big driver. It pulled heavier than 70% as a reason to do it. The education programs and then the economic impact of bringing tourists and tourist dollars into town, all tested in the 70s.
I'm wondering, once you add the aquarium, if you're able to get that done, you know, to what extent is the Kansas City Zoo, how does it stacking up against other zoos around the country? I know you're supposed to be the zoo's biggest booster, but having said that, give me some context here.
Yes, I am the zoo's biggest booster. There isn't it. Comparing a zoo to another zoo is apples and oranges, but really the success gets into how many memberships do you sell, how many visitors do you have, your kind of your operating budget. If you use those parameters, we came from far down on the list. We're probably in the top 30 now, and that's a good starting place.
Mm-hmm.
Hitting that million mark on attendance has been a goal of the city forever.
Is that a big benchmark
for a zoo? That's a big benchmark.
Mm-hmm.
But my friends up in Omaha, they do 2 million visitors a year. St. Louis does 3 million a year.
Wow.
So a million is a as a good starting point to say now we're entering the big arena.
That's Randy Westhoff. He heads the Kansas City Zoo, talking about that proposed new zoo aquarium. Randy, it's always great to have you here. Come back and let's talk a little bit more about the animals sometime.
Would love to anytime, Steve. Thanks for having us.
Again, Randy Westhoff. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about human rights around the globe. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we asked why big trucks weighing 80,000 pounds are not required to be equipped with automatic emergency braking. You can hear what we learned at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, a Missouri House seat has been vacated north of the river, and two candidates are vying for the job. We'll ask them where they stand on infrastructure and transportation issues, marijuana legislation, and unions. Join us for that conversation tomorrow on KCUR's Up-to-Date. Well, President Trump and human rights aren't meshing all that well these days. That's the view of Human Rights Watch, the nonprofit, non-governmental human rights organization that keeps a spotlight trained on problems worldwide. In fact, our guest today from Human Rights Watch has labeled the president one of the greatest threats to human rights in decades, and she points to Trump's comments on immigrants, healthcare, minority communities, and the justice system as evidence. Sarah Margon is the Washington Director at Human Rights Watch. In this role, she serves as the organization's main point of contact with the U.S. government. She speaks in town tonight. More on that in just a little bit. And she's going to speak to us right now. Sarah, welcome. So good to have you here.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
The president is one of the greatest threats to human rights in decades. That's what you wrote. Explain that to us.
Sure. I mean, human rights exist to protect people from government and from abuse. And what you have is a president who has not only neglected those protections in rhetoric, but also in concrete ways, both here at home in the United States and overseas.
How far outside the mainstream is this president when it comes to human rights and his lack of support for human rights around the globe?
That's a great question. I think the U.S. has suffered in many ways over decades for this tension between how do we engage on human rights and how do we engage on policy priorities. The difference with this president is that he has categorically pushed them to the side. On the foreign policy end of things, we have seen him sit down with some of the most abusive and autocratic leaders from Egypt, Russia, and align himself both in language, in policy, and sometimes in body language.
Your point is that no president has spoken about human rights the way this president has.
Yes, that's fair? That's very fair. He's also walked the U.S. back from a multilateral engagement position. He's pushing an isolationist agenda. He's using rhetoric that, as you well know, goes against the press, attacks the press in ways unseen. He has walked the U.S. back from negotiations and engagement on migration, on climate change. He walked the U.S. right out of the UN Human Rights Council, which is not a well-known entity, but it is a body that the U.S. has supported and tried to make better in years past.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah. And he's done that for a number of reasons. It's not a perfect body. It does deserve some criticism. But it's produced some really important items that have actually enabled and supported U.S. policy from Burma to North Korea to Syria over the years.
But to some extent, Sarah, he gets away with it. Why?
Well, his polling numbers do seem high here in the United States, and he, you know, has walked back some of his foreign aid contributions to the UN Refugee Agency that supports the Palestinian people. And because there are people at the other end of that, other governments have stepped up to fill in the gap. And so there is not blanket condemnation in the way that there might be, because many other governments don't want to see people suffer at the hands of a Trump decision, first of all.
Yeah.
Second of all, these are not changes in some cases that are going to make a difference overnight. So there's a long-term erosion of U.S. support and promotion for human rights. Human rights is not something that you can measure. A change in human rights is not something you can measure necessarily day by day or minute by minute. Mm-hmm. It's a long-term process.
Do you find all this discouraging? Again, referring to the president and his attitude here towards human rights.
I find watching the president engage and sometimes the language that comes out of his mouth so disheartening, embarrassing, and so at odds with sort of what I expect from a U.S. president. At the same time, though, I do know that there are so many people still in the U.S. government at the working level and certainly in Congress who are trying to push back. The other thing I would say is that the silver lining, perhaps, is that the American people have gotten up and gotten out, not just in issues of healthcare, but also on the role they expect America to play overseas. Mm-hmm. There is an understanding by so many Americans that values and rights matter, not just here in Kansas City, where, of course, they matter on a day-to-day level, but in the way the U.S. comports itself overseas. And that question of what is America's role in the world has come up at so many interesting and different levels where maybe it wasn't quite seen in the same way before.
Sarah Margon from Human Rights Watch is my guest. You know, I want to go back to the U.N. Human Rights Council, the U.S. pulling out of that. You referred to it here already. U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley blamed groups like yours for the pullout, as you know, saying non-governmental organizations were aligning themselves more with Russia and China than the U.S. She called the Rights Council dysfunctional, and she accused the council of having an anti-Israel bias and including members with lousy human rights records. What do you say to all that?
Well, I thought it was pretty astounding that she scapegoated Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and a number of other groups as the justification for pulling out. Some of the criticisms that Ambassador Haley levied against the UN Human Rights Council are ones we agree with. There isn't a transparent process of voting members onto the council. That's fair, and that should be changed. There are members on the council that have pretty terrible records. That also should not be allowed. But to say that the council is entirely ineffective as a result is just simply not the case. The council has shifted and reformed in some ways over the last couple of years, and we have seen some pretty remarkable reporting come out of the council. There's been, I will say, one of the most interesting reports I've ever read come out of the UN on North Korea that came out a couple of years ago. It was a 400-page document that really exposed for the first time in a consolidated way the abuses that have been going on in North Korea over decades. Just a couple of weeks ago, the investigative mechanism for Burma released a really compelling report about the travesty against the Rohingya people.
Right.
And it used very, very strong language. That was actually a U.S.-supported initiative. So there are tons of problems. Saudi Arabia, for example, sitting on the council, Democratic Republic of Congo. But that doesn't mean the council can't do better. It can't do good things. And especially when you have the UN Security Council in New York very paralyzed from doing anything on human rights because of Russia and China.
Yeah, tell me a little more about Human Rights Watch. Are you guys primarily an educational organization as opposed to boots on the ground?
We're a little bit of both.
Are
so
you?
We
okay.
are a research documentation organization. We work in over 90 countries globally, including here in the United States. We have researchers, or some people call them investigators, and they go out and they document abuses, patterns of abuses, and they put together a story kind of like a puzzle, and they check and double check to make sure what we've got is right, because our information is our credibility. It is what – it's our currency. And then we take that information and we produce reports and an analysis, and we put that out into the public domain. And they always come out with recommendations. And so then we use our media arm, our communications arm, and our advocacy arm to engage governments and relevant actors to try to make change. Sometimes that's on the national level, like in Nigeria. Sometimes it's international or with international organizations.
But how do you manage to counter a president whose rhetoric carries with it this hurricane force, and you're one organization out there trying to match that or combat that? It has to be a pretty tough fight.
It's a tough fight, but the credibility of our analysis is one of the important parts. It's gotten tougher, I would say, in this environment where facts don't seem to matter to certain people. That requires new strategies and new challenges and sometimes a new education campaign.
Yeah.
But, you know, we also align very closely with other organizations at the national level here in the United States, at the regional level. We work closely with individuals and governments that align with us. In the U.S., we work closely with members of Congress on both sides of the aisle. We're very, very bipartisan or nonpartisan in our work.
Mm-hmm. Sarah Margon will be speaking this evening at 6:30 at Stinson Leonard Street, the law firm, 1200 block of Walnut Street. More information, go to the International Relations Council Kansas City website. That's IRCKC.org, 6:30 this evening. Sarah will be giving an update on human rights around the globe. Speaking of that, what is the current state of human rights worldwide these days? Because I gather from your writings that the picture ain't very pretty these days.
We're in a tough place. And yeah. I think some of the mechanisms and the institutions that have been created to address these issues are also being dramatically undermined, which comes from presidents like Trump, unhelpful ones in other parts of the world, and frankly, some of the non-state actors who just don't care and are willing and happy to commit horrific abuses and then showcase it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look in countries like Saudi Arabia and Yemen, Saudi Arabia, everyone says they're reforming, they're changing. But in fact, they've just thrown a bunch of women in jail on bogus trumped-up charges, even after they said they were going to let them drive. So reform is not necessarily coming in quite the same way we thought. There's a horrific conflict in Yemen that we believe the U.S. is complicit in.
I was going to ask you about it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. The situation in Burma, you know, you've got nearly 800,000 people who have fled a military-led atrocity over the last year and are now in Bangladesh in pretty devastating conditions. And here in the U.S., you have a president who had literally been ripping kids away from their parents as they tried to cross the border and claim asylum.
Yeah, I was going to say, people think of Human Rights Watch and they might think of you guys targeting other nations and far-off lands. But in fact, you often train your sights right here at home.
We've got quite a lot of work going on the United States. We do a lot of work on immigration, on criminal justice. We've done many reports for years on Guantanamo, U.S. role overseas in the military. So we have a very robust program. We also work on women's issues here in the United States. We're starting to see the Trump administration attempt to restrict women's rights here at home the way mm-hmm. they have done overseas when it comes to reproductive rights and family planning.
People don't want to think of the United States as being on your radar screens.
It's really on our radar screen. And I would say that, you know, it's been like that for well over a decade, more in fact. And Trump in our minds is an outgrowth of a larger problem with the United States. The problems that we're dealing with here in the U.S. are not ones that suddenly emerged with the presidency of Trump. He is the outgrowth of a larger problem that we have to deal with as Americans.
Hmm. How do you make people aware of problems so far away? You mentioned Burma. Mm. You know, a lot of Americans have no idea where Burma is. And how do you engage Americans, engage your audience in problems that seem to have so little impact on people here at home?
We have a number of ways we do that. And I think we're constantly reevaluating what works, what interests people, and what they want to hear about. In some cases, to engage Americans or people here in the U.S., we look at where there are communities of diaspora and others who might be interested. We've increasingly used videos because we find that if you can see someone and see their story, that resonates.
Yeah.
We also are talking much more about, you know, local actions and engagement, because maybe the way to engage is not nationally in Washington, but it can also be here in Kansas City, engaging with a local organization that support refugees, or talking to your local council person or your local representative from Congress. All of this is meaningful. And like I said before, the silver lining of the Trump administration or President Trump himself is that Americans are hungry for action.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's an opportunity, I think, to use social media to engage. You know, if you're on Twitter, for example, maybe you're looking at what's happening here, but if you just type in the word Burma, you can start to see not only what the Kansas City Star is saying or what the New York Times is saying, but you can start to actually engage with organizations that are on the ground in Burma. It brings it much closer to home that way.
I'm wondering, we just lost John McCain, and your organization has written very admiringly, help me there, about him and the work he did for so many years. Tell us about the work of Senator John McCain.
He was a strong advocate for human rights in a number of ways. He believed American leadership was a very important part of engaging in human rights globally. It's important to say we didn't always agree with him. And in fact, there were many failings, I think, that Senator McCain would have acknowledged himself. We had lots of points of disagreement. But he was a strong champion for human rights defenders around the world, from Belarus to Burma to Brazil. He was active in traveling all over the world to see for himself. There are these stories of him going to prisons in Libya to meet with defenders or activists or opposition leaders who had been thrown in prison. He traveled to Syria. And so he really wanted to engage humans and individuals, not just governments. And he wasn't afraid to speak out, you know, against his own party, against abusers and autocrats. he stood up for Americans who were in prison in Egypt on bogus charges, but he also stood up for Egyptians who were in prison, which is often something you don't see because Egyptians in prison in Egypt don't vote for American political leaders.
So but a big loss.
It's a big loss.
What's the one hot spot around the world that has you the most concerned?
Ooh, it's hard to choose one. We've been training our eye in Venezuela recently, which is a lot closer to home. And the conflict in Yemen continues to rage, and the U.S. government is not being a helpful actor in any way there.
You disagree sharply with the administration's determination that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are doing enough to prevent civilian casualties in Yemen. We're talking about a situation where the Saudi coalition airstrikes have killed thousands of non-combatants. Yeah. How do you see that situation, Sarah?
To say that we disagree sharply is an understatement. I found the statements that came out yesterday that the Saudi-led coalition would actually do the right thing and investigate these civilians who are dying in Yemen to be a complete farce. We have done a lot of reporting not only on what's happening in Yemen, but recently we did a report on this mechanism that's supposed to do the investigating into the attacks that have killed civilians. We found that not only was it dysfunctional, it was untransparent, that it wasn't producing anything. It wasn't releasing anything. It has since made a statement about this school bus where children were killed. You may have seen that in the news. But to say that it could actually undertake an investigation into that school bus attack in a meaningful way and hold anyone accountable is just not true. They haven't done that to date. There's no reason to rely on them.
How dangerous is the reporting that Human Rights Watch journalists and staffers do around the world?
So on the one hand, it's very, very dangerous. And when I do my couple of missions overseas every year, my poor mother and father are always like, don't go, please don't go. We don't want you to do that.
I bet.
But at the same time, we are very strong in our local relations. We have networks of activists that we work closely with. We undertake really robust and rigorous security analysis. We don't want to put any of our staff in danger. We want to be there to tell the story. So we make decisions within a group internally, and we rely on a number of particular outside actors to help leverage our security, but we are very careful and we have to maintain our impartiality and independence in doing what we do.
That's Sarah Margon. She'll be speaking tonight at 6:30 at Stinson Leonard Street at 1201 Walnut Street in downtown Kansas City. More information, irckc.org. Sarah, thanks so much for the update. Sure appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow, when soldiers return from war, not all of the damage may be visible. Learn what moral injury is and how it impacts veterans tomorrow on Up to Date. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are Up to Date.